gave it and the person it belonged to. Roland blew visibly pale when I said it. How the hell did you get that? He stood. The blood returned to his face and his wide smile was gone. He was furious, afraid, and panicking. How? I guess I hocked my reflection for it. I said, sit the fuck down, Raleigh. Have another drink. We got business. Wayne English had done me one more solid, an ace in the hole. We had hacked into the Akashic record, the sum total of all human knowledge, past, present, and future, and found a long-hidden name for me, Roland Blue's true name. That simple identifier gave me direct access into the man's soul, into the very core of him. The Akashic was tricky to navigate, and English was the only wizard still alive that I knew who wasn't afraid to go in there. Complex questions with complex answers could take weeks or longer to be answered, but a single name, obscured by packed magic with nickel-and-dime entities that the Acid Master could dig up in the short time I had given him. "You son of a bitch," Blue said. "I should have known you wouldn't show your ass to me unless you had a fucking ringer. You've always been a sneaky piece of shit, Ballard. You remember Logan Goddard?" "Yeah," I said. "You guys were tight, went way back." "You remember killing him? Hitting him with a cheap-as-fuck spell from behind?" "Vaguely," I said. "I was pretty high at the time. I killed him because he was your friend, Raleigh. I thought you should know that." "You fucking mouth-breathing redneck bastard," he said. I felt him marshaling his power, drawing on his rage to build an invisible murder machine. "You think I'd go to the trouble of digging up your true name and walk in here unless I had something special to lay you out with?" I said, "drop that working or you die right now." Blue released it. It fluttered angry and hot between us for an instant, then it was gone. I smiled. Blue glared at me across the desk. "You're going to tell me who yanks Brett Glad's chain," I said, "or I will give your true name to every second-rate demon, back alley spirit and negative entity you've hustled or shook down over your illustrious career. They won't find a body. They won't even find a grease spot of the great Roland Blue." A dry, rasping chuckle seemed to emanate from inside the cerulean-colored tie. "But first, the warm-up round. Crystal Myth," I said, "Anku's daughter. You said she split. You and the Dugpa must have looked for her. They had too much invested in her, and you saw her as too good a meal ticket to just let slip away." Blue nodded, his gangster cool shattered. He was pale and sweaty now, just like me. "You feeling that?" he said, rubbing his face. "Like someone crapping inside me, like catching the flu on the fucking wind. What the fuck is that?" "The girl, Raleigh," I said. He nodded, wiped his head, and rubbed the sweat onto his pants leg. I was feeling claustrophobic, like I needed to throw up, to run. Yeah, we turned the city up as much as we could looking for her," he said. "Buses, trains, airport, zip. We thought we might have her when she went to the dock they sent all the girls to, but she never showed." "Doctor," I said. I could feel it now, the pressure on my ajna chakra, like a psychic sinus headache. "She needed a doctor?" "She was in, you know, a family way." I remembered what the weatherman had told me about Cairn getting sick at the party and saying she was pregnant to Red. "The Dugpa had me send all their girls that got knocked up to this one doctor. She never showed up, though." All my instincts were in fight-or-flight mode, and I honestly couldn't figure out why. Blue's office's defense were fine. Something was wrong, but I had no clue from where. It was time to wrap this up and get the hell out of here. "Now for the grand prize," I said. "I forget your true name, and we never had this chat. Who runs the Dugpa, Raleigh? Who's Glide's boss, and how do I find him?" Something was shitting itself into our world, our space-time right on top of us, a tumor made of infected emotion. Shadows deepened, stretched, grasped at the edge of the room as the linkages to our world shivered and warped. "Raleigh." I stood, knocking my chair to the floor. Blue stood as well, feeling its arrival, realizing as I did that the ill feelings we had both been experiencing were our world fighting off the infection of this invader. I felt Blue's defenses rise around him, and I snapped mine up too. It was here, tearing through the membrane of the real, born out of nothing, spewing malice as afterbirth. The thing creaked on three rubber wheels instead of legs and feet. One of the wheels was palsied like a broken shopping cart's. It sped out of the darkness it brought with it and came directly at Roland. Its face was crumpled metal married to savaged flesh, partly hidden by a blood-soaked surgical mask. Blue spit out a curt spell and gestured with his hand toward the thing. There was an arc of purple electricity from the gangster to the creature, but it didn't even slow it down. I brought my hands together like a funnel and sent directed Ajna force from a third eye into the thing, a spear made of pure thought. That got its attention a little, I thought it might. It had six arms, three on each side of its boxy metal torso, all of them like flexible steel cables, smeared in blood and oil. The arms were growing blades like petals opening on a flower. Two of the arms shot toward me, growing, stretching at dizzying speed. I dove for cover under the heavy marble table. The table shattered, taking the hit for me from one of the tentacles. The other sliced into my back, and I screamed as multiple knives stabbed me and then spun in the wounds. I looked up to see Roland Blue being run through, torn and shredded by the spinning bladed arms. He screamed as long as I had the functioning equipment to do that. Then he just sagged and jerked. Some of his blood splashed on my face. More of it, and the soupy parts of him splattered on the stainless steel tray of rusted surgical instruments that was bolted to Crash Cart's torso. I reached back and tugged at the alien, unyielding arm that was tearing apart my back and headed toward my spine. It was too strong, too slippery with fluids. The arm that had shattered the marble desk was headed for my face, its blades whirring. I heard the pop, pop, pop of small arms fire and the chatter of machine gun fire as the office door crashed open. I knew none of it would do any good, any more than any spell, any effort. Crash Cart was a mental projection, imagination given form and power. There was only one way to stop it. I knew what I had to do, and I had to do it now. No hesitation, not a grain of doubt in my mind, no fuzzy thinking, no distraction. The blades came at my face. The pain in my back was burning, twisting, humming, agony. I closed my eyes, stayed crouched under the ruined desk, and began the earth mudras with my hands and fingers, willing them to not tremble. I tried to remember what Wayne English had taught me so briefly about his own war with these nightmares given substance so long ago. I had to calm my mind. There was no Crash Cart. There was no pain, no wounds. There was only the clean, bright, endless intellect. I was anchored to the world, and it was anchored to me. There was no second before impact, no second before my spinal cord was severed. There was no time. It was a shade, a trick, a lie of possession, of attachment. There was nothing. It was all a sick dream, and I gave it no power over me. In this I was infinite. Not a single atom of my being doubted, flinched. It was nothing. I opened my eyes. The pain in my back was gone. My spine was intact. No blades had touched my face. Roland Blue's body, his bloody, hewn face, was a few inches from me on the floor. His eyes, my eyes, even to the last second of life, could no longer see me. His lips formed a word, summoning a bubble of blood to his mouth. The dark bubble popped and he died, the life leaving my reflected eyes. Then the eyes themselves faded, leaving only bloody empty sockets. I glanced over to see my spilled whiskey glass, the amber liquid pooling on the floor with melting ice. Crash Cart was still manifested, ripping into Blue's men now. Vigil, with twin pistols he'd acquired from some of Roland's dead soldiers, was blasting away, making a valiant charge at the creature. He'd die. I stumbled to my feet and tackled him in mid-charge, driving both of us, crashing through Blue's office window and plummeting down to the stage below in a rain of bloody glass. We both hit hard, and the crowd gasped and then shouted angrily. Vigil and I helped each other to our feet, and he fired off around into the air. The crowd's anger at us ruining the show was replaced with squeals of fear and lemming-like running for the exits.
"What the hell was that for?"
he asked, brushing glass off himself and scanning the panicking crowd for Blue's security. "The only way to not get killed by that thing is to be absolutely certain it's not real," I said. "It would have done to you what it did to Roland and was trying to do to me." Above us, from the shattered office window, there was the burp of automatic weapons fire. screams, and then silence. We need to get the fuck out of here. It was sent to shut Blue up, but I'm pretty sure it will be happy to slaughter every single person in this building. As if to punctuate my point, there was more screaming and the squeak of rubber wheels from up on the catwalk. I saw some of Blue's pit security headed our way, fighting against the stream of fleeing customers. I headed for one of the stage exits, but looked back to see Vigil walking toward the unicorn. "We don't have time for this shit," I shouted. Vigil stuffed a pistol in his waistband and leveled the other 9mm in the direction of the oncoming gunman. A beautiful knife with an ornately engraved silver hilt and a blue, glowing crystal blade about a foot long sizzled into being in Vigil's free hand. "You have a soulbound knife?" I said, shaking glass out of my scalp. "Where the fuck did you get that from?" A soulbound weapon was tricky, high-order magic. It was knitted into the very essence of the wielder. Very few mages were adept enough to even try it, and few people had the focus and discipline to endure having the weapon tattooed onto their soul.
"Shut up," Vigil said.
The hissing blade sliced through the mythical beast's enchanted collar. The warding symbols on the steel flared red-hot for an instant and then faded as the smoking metal hit the stained floor of the stage.
"I know people, too."
The unicorn met Vigil's gaze, snorted, and pawed the stage. It lowered its head, touching the tip of its horn to the knight's shoulder. Then it reared up, its hooves pawing the air, and faded away in a soft white light into nothingness. I helped the naked, traumatized sea-nymph to her feet. Vigil sliced off her collar as well, and she gave him a slight sigh as she became seawater, soaking us in the stage floor. A few of Blue's men, who hadn't realized yet they were out of a job, were stepping onto the stage through one of the gate entrances. Vigil aimed the gun at them, thumbed back the hammer, and placed his finger on the trigger.
"You're looking for this?"
he asked calmly. What they saw in his eyes made them slowly retreat. Vigil lowered the gun and looked around at the stage.
"No,"
he said, releasing the hilt of the cracking, sputtering soul knife so that it evaporated back into nothing.
"We can go."
21. We made our way through the tide of panicked patrons at the Iron Cauldron, scrambling to the exits ahead of the sounds of screams and gunfire. I looked over to the weatherman's booth to give them the signal to cut out, but they were already long gone. Outside, we met up with Dwayne and Gretchen and started down the street toward the car. I didn't see the golems.
"What a mess,"
the urban shaman said, looking back.
"Shouldn't we do something to help?"
"We are," I said. "We're getting the fuck out of the way. We already unlocked our compassion achievement for the night." Vigil gave me a dirty look. "That thing will run out of steam if the remaining security are smart enough to leave it alone." There was a rumble of automatic weapons, which got the fleeing crowd shrieking again. "Roland always hired cut-rate help," I said. Back at the Trevita, the secure satellite phone Vigil had given me chirped. I looked at the screen and noticed I had missed 3 other calls, all from the same number. "Yeah," I said. "It's Anna. I got a lead on your girl, Crystal. Can you meet me now?" I convinced Vigil and Dwayne to head back to the horrid limit. Strangely, Vigil didn't give me any shit. He seemed lost in his own head. Some of the revelations from the weatherman about Cairn's drug use and pregnancy had hit him harder than it had me. I also think the exposure to in-your-face grotto had created a toxic waste dump in his skull that he was still trying to decontaminate. Vigil was chasing the ideal of Cairn Anku, the princess, the little girl lost. He still believed in a just world. I just wanted to inspect the wreckage of the real world and see what, if anything, could be salvaged. One of the few advantages to being a monster was that life seldom disappointed you anymore. This was going to get harder on Vigil before it got easier. I met Anna and another woman at a coffee shop called Cafe Spot on West 6th. It was 3 in the morning, and the place had only a few patrons. I was now officially at my deadline time to be out of L.A. I managed to bury my panic with a yawn. One of the local jazz radio stations was playing softly on the ceiling speakers. I slid into a seat and ordered a cheer wine, got my usual response, and ordered a large coffee black and lit a cigarette. Anna's friend tried to hide her disgust. "I knew there was no smoking in here. Hell, most of L.A. was no smoking. I'm kind of an arch-villain like that. I seldom return library books in a timely fashion either."
"This is a
friend of mine, Anna said to me. Dr. Alexis Matos. I think she might be able to help you. Alex, this is Lathan Ballard.
It dawned on me that Dr. Matos, who was perhaps of Hispanic descent, bore a striking resemblance to Anna in build, hairstyle, color, and even her delicate features. The doc's eyes were a warm brown as opposed to Anna's blue, and her skin tone was darker than Anna's. Still, I was pretty sure friend meant client, and the notion of the two of them together was a pleasant one.
Tell him what you and I discussed, please. You can trust his discretion.
I looked like a street bum who'd been run over by a taxi. My hands shook with the beginning of the DTs as I sipped my coffee, and I was pulling away, killing random faceless hipsters with my secondhand smoke. Dr. Matos looked at Anna skeptically.
Anna, I... What did you just call me?
Anna said quietly, almost politely.
Mistress,
the doctor corrected, her eyes darkening in fear, possibly arousal.
Are you sure he's... Tell him what I instructed you to tell him, Alexis,
Anna said, her voice still even, conversational, not a hint of threat or malice in it.
Yes,
Dr. Matos swallowed hard. Mistress. She looked to me and managed to get her composure back quickly.
You're looking for a young woman who was working in adult entertainment out here. I'm a plastic surgeon. My practice is in Beverly Hills, and I do a lot of work for that particular industry, most of it through production companies or agents. Your Crystal Myth wasn't one of my clients, but I have heard the name from some of my patients.
Do you know who Red Hat Productions used as doctors for their talent? I asked.
I've met Brett Glide at numerous social functions, Maddow said. He's charming, well-educated, compassionate. He donated over $500,000 personally last year to local charities that help children. Not what you'd expect from a pornographer.
Yeah, I said, he's a prince, the Albert Schweitzer of the money shot.
Maddow's made the stank face again, glared to Anna, and then resumed. Glenn Tobias, she said. He's an OBGYN. A really good one. Has a lot of A-list celebrity patients. He is also the go-to resource for all the latest infertility treatment therapies. He's given superstars mega babies when everyone else said they'd never conceive. He's a miracle worker. I've also heard he has patients from Glide, from Red Hat. He doesn't advertise that, obviously. Why on earth a man as talented and well-off as he is would do that kind of work? I heard that Glenn performed abortion procedures for some of the performers. I also heard that he acted as physician for several of the porn actresses that carried their children to term. He's very active with many private adoption services. Placing children.
A sick feeling slithered through my guts like an oily snake. I asked Anna for the scrap of prescription pad I'd found. You ever hear of Crystal Myth being one of his patients? Have you ever heard anything about Glide or this Dr. Tobias having anything to do with a guy named Roland Blue?
Some of my patients said Crystal had been to see Dr. Tobias numerous times over her career, Motto said, after she started working for and dating Brett. I'm afraid I've never heard of a Roland Blue before.
Yeah, you won't be hearing anything about him either, I said. Anna handed the torn prescription pad to Matos.
This looked like it might belong to anyone you know. No, Matos said. Do you have any idea how many doctors, public, private, shadow, and street there are in the greater Los Angeles area? You have part of a number and a bit of a name. I'm sorry, I can't help you with that, Mr. Ballard.
It's okay. I took back the prescription scrap. You've helped. Could you do me one last favor, Doc? If you know them, give me the names of the adoption agencies Tobias has helped out in the past. I excused myself from the table. I didn't offer to shake Matos's hand, and she didn't offer it. Anna walked with me to the door and just outside the coffee shop. It had started to rain, and the tires of the cars running up Sixth whooshed as they drove by.
Did that help? Really?
Anna asked. I nodded. Yes, thank you. I know you like to keep your business, but that filled in a few more pieces for me. If this is what I think it is, it's ugly, Anna. I can't walk away from any of this.
You're out of time, she said. Dragon will have to bring you in if she sees you. Don't do that to her, Latham. This whole mess, you, it's brought up so many bad memories and emotions for her.
And for you, I said. I wish there was some way I could tell you how sorry I am for what I've done. There isn't. I can try to keep you two out of the rest of this as best I can. It's all I can do. I'll make sure me and the crew are out of the limit tonight.
Take care of yourself, Latham,
she said, and caressed my cheek as gently as the rain.
We still love you, and you're still our family, always.
I wanted to kiss her, but I knew it would just tangle her up inside. If I'd had a few drinks in me, I would have done it anyway. Another pro to drinking, kissing more beautiful women. I smiled and shuffled off down the street to find a cab.
Ballard,
Anna called after me. I stopped and turned, looking a bit like junk-tripping John Travolta in Pulp Fiction.
We believe in you, even if you don't anymore.
The thought of that kept me warm until a cabbie, a broad-shouldered Samoan, took pity on my drowned ass and picked me up.
Where to?
The driver asked. I handed him $100. I have no fucking clue, I said. Drive me around for a bit and let me see what I can scrounge up. The cabbie grunted and pulled out into the sporadic 4 a.m. traffic. I called Grinner on the secure cell. I need you to do a little more digging, I said.
Do you actually comprehend the meaning of get the hell out of Dodge?
He asked.
I am packing. I'm going to the airport. I am lying to all the nice TSA people about, well, everything, and I'm getting out of this clusterfuck of a town. I do have some more intel cooking for you about Glide, but just for yucks, what you need.
I told Grinner what had happened at the Iron Cauldron, what Blue had told me before Crash Card had turned him into salsa, and what I had gleaned from Dr. Maddow's. It would have been funny watching the cabbie's face in the mirror as I laid it all out, but the cold rain had gotten into my bones, and I was having trouble not shuddering like a sick old dog. My blood was freezing acid, and it screamed for a drink, a line of coke, a hit of speed, a benzo, anything to stop the ugly burden of me. I gave it a cigarette and told it to shut up.
Hey, you can't smoke in here, man,
the driver began as I blew my first lung full of smoke out the open rear window. I handed him another $100 with a rapidly steadying hand, and he acquiesced.
So, what you thinking?
Grinner asked.
The Dugpar doing something with the babies of the sacrificial victims?
Maybe it's sick as fuck to even comprehend, I said. Manson said something to me about children being the way to immortality, to control the future. To bake a successful Dugpa, you'd have to start indoctrinating them young. You can't get much younger than right out of the oven.
Especially when you own the bakery. That is fucked up,
Grinner said.
Okay, you want me to dig into this Dr. Tobias and those adoption agencies and see if I can find any trace of your girl in there?
Any of our victims, I said. Not just Crystal. See what you can dig up. This is important.
Isn't it always? He said. Meet me in parking at LAX about 11 this morning. I can give you whatever I got by then. My flight leaves at noon.
He hung up. I drove around in the pre-dawn rain, feeding the cabbie money occasionally. I think I slept for a little bit. I had discovered over a lifetime of wandering that the back of cabs was one of my few safe places. I had an old sliver of a memory in my skull, and the places I seldom visited, never dwelled in. It was of Mom and Pa. It was my last solid memory of life with my Pa. He was driving us somewhere in that baby shit brown 73 Buick Riviera. It was raining, like it was now, and I was stretched out in the back seat, mostly asleep. They were talking softly. Charlie Rich's The Most Beautiful Girl in the World was playing on the hissing AM radio, quietly competing with the rain on the roof and the hypnotic creak of the rushing wipers to be heard. They sang along, and I could hear, feel the love between them. I could smell Pa's tobacco, sweet and musky. His death was not far away, and out there just past the headlights in the onrushing future. It is my last memory of normal, of childhood, I retained, and it often tiptoed out of the ramshackle haunted house of my mind when I sat exhausted, safe in the back seat. What, Elextra? Peggy had said to me about feeling safe in the back seat of a car came back to me, too. Normal people had scrapbooks. Maybe broken people had the back seat of cars. My phone buzzed and shocked me awake. I figured it would be Grinner, but it was a local number I didn't immediately recognize. I answered. It was Gus Gilwaski, the erstwhile leader of the Weathermen.
"I'm sorry if I woke you, Latham," he said.
I could hear Doris Day playing on vinyl in the background.
No, Gus, it's okay. I'm good. What's up?"
"I did a divination as soon as I got home," he said. "I wanted to get you the results as soon as possible. I hope they will help your investigation."
"What you got for me, Gus?" I was surprised he had actually done it.
"Well,"
the Taromancer said,
"first of all, Crystal Myth herself is blocked from view by scrying. It's powerful and old magic, probably related to her fey heritage. Maybe some kind of talisman or charm."
That made sense. Anku had scoured the world for his daughter and had told me he had employed every resource, mundane or occult, at his disposal, including looking for her in the legendary revealing waters of Elfini in the ancient fey homeland.
"However,"
Gus continued,
"I was able to get a read off of the young man who argued with Glyde at the party we saw Crystal at. He's with her now, and he has a strange dichotomy about him. He has been ally and nemesis to the now late Roland Blue."
None of this was knocking my socks off. However, the fact that the guy was still with her was helpful. Maybe Blue had put her on ice somewhere. Maybe the mystery man was one of Blue's men and had decided to see if he could make his own deal with Anku for Karen and had rabbited with her. If that was the case, what the hell was he waiting for? It had been years since she had vanished from L.A. Unknown guy's presence just created more questions than answers. "Thanks, Gus," I said. "I really appreciate—"
"Wait,"
he said, almost breathless.
"I saved the best for last. I got an audible divination."
"Oh," I said. "Okay. That's great, Gus, really. Let me give you the 411 on Tyromancy. It's divination through the use of cheese." "Yeah, sexy, right?" "There are many different styles of doing it. In Gus's case, he viewed the formation of hulls, of curds, of mold as the cheese coagulated. Then finally he inserted various parts of his body into the fermenting dairy product and listened to the sounds that produced. So, an audible response."
"Ew."
"Then I think, who am I to judge? What a man and his consenting cheese do in the privacy of their own home isn't any of my damn business. Did I mention all weathermen are kind of weird?"
"It said very clearly,"
Gus said, as que sera sera played behind him.
"Leucadia."
"Leucadia," I said. "Gus, what the fuck does that even mean?"
"Leucadia," the back of the cab driver's head said. "It's down south on the coast. It's a less developed section of Encinitas, a little over 2 hours from here. Nice place, Encinitas. Me and my buddies used to hit the beach down there in college to surf. It was mostly farms and some horse ranches back then."
"No shit,"
I asked.
"No shit," the driver said without missing a beat. I could hear Gus's grin over the line.
"I do good?"
Gus asked. "Gus, you did great," I said. "I owe you one."
"Wow, no kidding. Latham Ballard owes me one,"
I chuckled. "Gotta run. Tell the boys next time I'm in town we will wreck it. Drinks on me."
"Will do. Go get 'em, Latham, but be careful. I saw some death coming. I'm sorry."
"It's okay," I said. "Take care, Gus." I hung up the phone. I slid another 100 to the driver. "What's your name?" I asked.
"Santos," he said. "John Santos."
He took the bill without looking back.
"Encinita Santos?"
"It's like 5 in the morning, Santos said. "I'm off shift in an hour. My wife, Rose, she's gonna kill me. But sure, why the hell not? This has been the most lucrative night of my career so far. And you are definitely the best passenger story I've ever had. All that shit about monsters and supernatural sex clubs. Charles Manson. You really some kind of a cult, whatever?"
I leaned back in the seat and pulled up a browser on the smartphone. An occult whatever. I said, yeah, that I am. I caught an hour's sleep on the ride down I-5 South. Before I crashed, I did a quick web search for doctors, primarily OBGYN in Encinitas. I found one that fit all the letters and numbers I needed to spin and complete the puzzle. Pat. Her name was Dr. Patricia Nahn, and I managed to come up with her office and home address with some digging. By 7:30, Santos and I were in the parking lot of her practice when she drove up in a forest green Jag. I recognized her from her Facebook picture. Blonde hair to her shoulders, thick black glasses. She dressed like a soccer mom. Dr. Nahn headed toward the locked doors of her lobby, looking a little oddly at Santos' L.A. cab. I stepped out into the morning light and felt the nausea of an all-nighter catch up to me. I looked like a drowned rat that had managed to find a dry hole for a spell. I was not at my most charming. Dr. Nahn? She had her keys out and turned to me, slipping the door key between her index and middle finger, ready to use as a weapon if need be against my sketchy presence fucking up her nice morning commute of Starbucks and NPR.
Yes, can I help you?
Crystal Myth, I said. Karen. The recognition was undeniable. She knew. The doc turned and crossed to the door, her sensible heels clicking on the pavement.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
She was fumbling with her keys, which rattled hard in her shaking hand.
Now please leave. This is private property and for patients only.
The door clicked open.
If you don't go, I'm calling the police.
Please do, I said, walking toward her. We can swap stories about how you're doing abortion work for porn stars. I'm sure your other clientele will get a kick out of that. The doc spun, angry, as she looked around to see if anyone had heard me.
I've done no such thing,
she said, and I believed her.
Karen was a patient of mine. It's none of your damned business. Hasn't that girl been through enough?
Yeah, I think she has, I said, and there is more trouble headed her way if you don't help me.
Why should I trust you?
She said, looking me up and down. You're not catching me at my best, I said. Actually, that's not true. I'm pretty much always a hot mess. I was hired by friends of hers to make sure she's alive and okay.
Like a private detective?
She asked. Yeah, something like that, I said. She's alive, happy, and wants to stay anonymous. I'll honor that.
She is,
Nahn said. I need to see her to be sure, I said. There are some evil bastards back in L.A. who wanted to use her, and they were going to kill her. They're still out there.
I know,
the doctor said.
She came to me a disaster. A junkie, 3.5 months pregnant. At the verge of a nervous breakdown, the things they did to her.
A car pulled in next to her Jag, the office manager, I suspected. It was coming up on 8.
Tell me, how do I know you're not one of those evil bastards from L.A.?
I am an evil bastard, I said. I guarantee you I'm the worst you'll ever meet, but I'm not their evil bastard. 8:15 and Santos's cab pulled to the curb across the street from a pale blue shingled rancher on Cathy Lane. A few of the yards in this quiet little suburb were dotted with palm trees. There were swing sets and above-ground pools you'd buy at Walmart, grills and boats under blue plastic tarps. It looked like a really nice place to live, to grow up, to grow old, as far away from L.A.'s porn scene or the life as you could possibly find. I felt like an invader here, a virus. I didn't belong.
You cool?
Santos asked, sipping his third coffee. I flicked the cigarette out the window and crushed it with my boot as I stepped to the curb.
Yeah, I said, just been a long time getting here. I could take you back to L.A., he said. You can leave her be.
I have to, I said. I have to see if she actually got herself the fuck out of hell and made it to Candyland. I need to know. Santos nodded.
I'll be waiting, he said.
I headed up the walk, avoiding some scattered toys and a garden hose that hadn't been rolled back up and stood at the door. For a second, the nightmare creaking of crashed carts' wheels filled my imagination, and I thought of walking into another murder scene. Blood and flesh sprayed everywhere. I pushed the images, the stench of slaughter out of my mind. I could go away. I could tell Anku anything I wanted, and Vigil would back me up. I was sure of that now. I didn't have to do this. I knocked on the door for the most selfish of reasons, not to free Tori Lynn from servitude, not to see if this girl was okay, not a hostage or someone's domestic slave. I knocked because I wanted to believe with all my heart that she had made it out the other side, and I had to see that. Had to know it was possible. The door opened. I heard children's music. I think it was from the Nickelodeon TV channel. The house smelled of breakfast and baby powder. Karen Anku, in her early 20s and still beautiful, opened the door. She was in a white cami and jeans, barefoot. A baby bump peeked out under the cami. She had scars on her arms, but they had mostly faded to pale, slightly raised shadows. The only jewelry she wore was a bracelet of unevenly shaped purple quartz and silver filigree. Her blonde hair was pulled back into a ponytail. She had a beautiful tattoo of a butterfly on her upper right bicep, in hues of purple and gold, and her eyes in the morning sunlight reminded me of stained glass. She looked at me wide-eyed and happy for a second.
"Hi,"
she said.
"Can I help you?"
I paused, just feeling the radiance of her, the life in her. It was like basking in sunlight. Then the clouds smothered the sun. I saw the look of old fear and distrust slide across her face. Her fingers moved to the edge of the door, ready to slam it. "Hello, Karen," I said.
22.
Karen Anku gestured for me to enter without another word. She looked sick and frightened.
"This way, please. I don't want us to disturb my son."
She led me through the airy, bright house, through a den where a little boy with mocha skin, a mop of unruly black curls and a slight point to the tips of his ears, sat in front of a flat-screen TV and watched cartoons, something called the Aquanauts. He looked up at me and smiled. I felt his soul pouring out of that simple smile.
"Hi,"
he said. He looked to be about 2, maybe a little younger.
"Hey,"
I said.
"In here,"
Karen said to me, an edge in her voice.
"Garland, you watch your shows. Mommy and our guest have some things to talk about, okay?"
"Okay,"
Garland said, already over the novelty of me and back to the adventures of singing aquatic animals. Karen led me to the rear of the house, to an open and sun-filled kitchen with an island for dining. We could still see the boy. There were no doors between the two rooms. Karen sat, struggling a bit to get up on a high stool while cradling her belly. I helped her as much as she'd allow, and then sat myself in the chair on the other side of the island, which was littered with junk mail, breakfast dishes, brightly colored plastic, children's bowls decorated with Disney characters, and sippy cups. She had coffee, but offered me none.
"Who sent you?"
she asked.
"Roland Blue. Brett, my father."
"I'm here on my own," I said. "I was hired by your dad to find you and bring you home." Karen snorted and shook her head.
"It figures,"
she said.
"I've felt him for years, probing, seeking. This,"
she said, holding up the purple crystal bracelet on her wrist,
"was my mother's. It's powerful, from the first land, and it hides me from the far sight. I stole it from her jewelry box after she died when I left."
"I know you have no reason to believe me, but I'm here to make sure you're okay, not make you go home."
She sighed. "I'm inclined to believe you're not one of my father's men. You knocked and didn't try to kick the door down or grab me and Garland and throw a bag over our heads in some parking lot. How long have you been looking for us?"
"A few months," I said.
"You must be good. He's been hunting the globe for me for 9, 10 years. Well, his proxies have. He's too busy to do it himself."
"I had a lot of help from my friends," I said.
"Is that why you left? You didn't think he had time for you after your mother passed?" "Look, Mr.
Ballard, just Ballard."
"Look, Ballard, no matter how much you've dug to get here, you don't know me. You don't know my life. And you surely have no idea about Theodore Anku."
"You're right, I don't know your life. I took this job for 2 reasons. One was a reward your dad promised me, and 2 is because I cut out from home at 13 too.
I had reasons. One of them was a mother so deep up a bottle she could have been a model ship. I fed myself, looked after myself and her, too. I understand not feeling loved. Do you ever patch things up with your mom? She asked. Ever go home again?
No, I said. I didn't. She's dead now.
I'd told the lie about her death so often now that even I believed it most of the time. I wondered for a moment if maybe she really was dead by now. Then I pushed the thought away and focused on the now.
Well, it wasn't for lack of attention, exactly, she said.
She paused, and I saw her pushing herself out of the dark vault of memory, too.
You want something to drink? Tea? Coffee?
Coffee would be great, I said. As she fixed me a cup, opening and closing cabinets as she did, I turned to watch her son, Garland, in the other room. He was transfixed by the TV, most of his chubby little hand covered in drool and propped in a ball between his lips. He's a beautiful kid. Where's Dad?
At work, she said, handing me a cup. Thank you. He's the most beautiful part of this world, or any other, that I've ever seen.
She was concealing something under the table. A weapon, I figured, maybe a kitchen knife. I didn't blame her.
He left not too long before you showed up. I figured you had waited until he was gone.
You give me too much credit, I said, breathing in the hot black coffee like it was the secret of life, which of course it was. I just showed up. My cab is still waiting out there full of sinister-looking fey gunsels. She smiled at that, and it was like the whole universe got a touch warmer, brighter. I set my coffee.
Gunsel? You out of a Humphrey Bogart movie or something? She asked.
Close enough, I said. I'm impressed someone your age even knows who Humphrey Bogart is.
My mom loved old movies, she said. When Father was away on work, I'd hole up in her bed with her and we'd watch all the old movies. I loved The Maltese Falcon and The Big Sleep. Casablanca was my favorite bogey movie.
Mine too, I said. I got to your front door mostly through being persistent and some dumb luck, both of which make up about 90% of detective work.
What happened? Why did you take off from home?
How'd you get away from Glide? I know some of it, but there are gaps.
Do you really care?
She asked.
I mean, it's mission accomplished now, right? Grab me, grab Garland, and take us back with that big paycheck. Why would you give a damn?
No paycheck, I said. Someone I love. She's trapped in slavery to the court of the uncountable stairs. I owe her to try to get her out of that. He promised to free her if I found you. And I told him if I did find you, I wouldn't make you go anywhere you didn't want to go. He has no clue about your life here, about your family, Garland. I nodded toward her belly. Or baby number two. A look of relief washed over Karen's face.
He doesn't know?
She slumped a little, then looked at me, searching my face, my eyes.
You're sure? Please, you can't tell him about the children, Ballard.
She was trying to stay calm, I could see that, but a desperate, panicked energy was creeping into her voice. Whatever she had hidden under the table, she was clutching it like a lifeline. I saw Garland turn his head, as he sensed the same thing I did from his mother.
Why did you run away, Karen?
I asked, keeping my voice low, putting down the coffee, leaning toward her.
When Mom was alive, everything seemed normal, sane, just life, you know,
she began hesitantly.
Father was always busy with his work, his political and business battles. It made him happy. He was a good husband to Mom. He was kind to me, generous, but always standoffish. But I didn't find out why until later.
She closed her eyes and cradled her coffee mug, like it was giving her warmth, sanctuary, from a bitter cold. She glanced to her boy, who was back to watching cartoons. Garland looked at his mom and she smiled at him. He went back to talking platypuses.
Then Mom was gone,
she said, having recovered enough strength from her ghosts and her child to continue.
And everything changed. It was bad. He shipped me back off to those expensive schools I'd spent half my life at. holidays were... I was alone. Since Garland was born, Joey and I have celebrated every goddamn holiday with him. We go overboard. We decorate the whole house. We make up all these stupid rituals. Joey makes up songs to sing to him.
The summer returned to her, and I could feel it. It was part of her fey nature. The world mirrored her moods. When she laughed, there was birdsong. When she wept, the rain was cold.
I swore back then, sitting alone at a fucking million-dollar dining table on Christmas Eve, a feast laid out before me for me to eat by myself, presents to open with no one, that this would never happen to my kid.
I was silent. I tried to recall a holiday that hadn't involved a hotel room and a bottle. I couldn't. Karen sighed and looked to Garland again. Then she went on.
He came to some big event at my school on Spetsis a few months after I turned 13. It was expected all the parents would jet in for it, so of course he came. I think it was a concert or something. Afterward, we went out to dinner and he was different toward me. He paid attention to what I said. He actually listened and we had a conversation instead of him just waiting for me to shut up so he could talk. He was engaged. For the first time in my life, he acted like I was more than just an obligation, like a power bill or changing out the litter box.
She swallowed hard as the memory played out and her eyes got wet. She choked back a sob with a feeble laugh and sniffed.
I should have fucking known, right? That night, when we were alone and away from everyone, he told me how beautiful I was. What a beautiful woman I had become, so like Mom.
She was fighting hard to stay in the present, and I wished I could say or do anything to help her in this, but I knew I couldn't. This was hers alone.
He'd never talked to me that way. Never. Then he tried to touch me. I managed to slip away. Get away before he...
I thought she was going to fall apart. She didn't. She rubbed her face, rubbed her eyes, exhaled, and sat up straight.
He told me I had a family obligation to him, to our name, since Mom hadn't given him an heir fit to take his place. You see, I wasn't good enough to run the empire. I didn't have the requisite equipment, it seems. He told me he had to make sure the Anku line remained pure, not polluted, tainted with human blood.
She looked at her boy again, and the anger made her trembling voice strong.
It was our duty to keep the blood pure. What a crock of shit. He left the next day without saying another word to me. I went home a few months later when I knew he was away, and I took a few things that mattered to me, and I never came back. I never will.
He gave me some line about an arranged marriage. There was some snobby little noble guy there he said was supposed to be your husband. She made a choked sound that might have been an attempt at a laugh. It got stuck in her throat.
Yeah, that was the cover. He'd get me pregnant, and then he'd marry me off to some house he wanted to control, and we'd all claim the baby was from the marriage. Only the really old-school fae still go in for the incest thing, so we had to keep this our little secret. It makes me sick, just thinking about it.
You fell in with Glide and the Doug Bacult not too long after you hit L.A., I said. She nodded.
They don't call themselves a cult. Everybody just knows everybody in it,
she said.
They don't wear robes or dance around pentagrams or anything stupid like that. Brett seemed so nice. I should have known. You'd think I would have learned. Nice acting guys fuck you over.
I honestly couldn't say, I said, never having been one.
Yeah, I can see that in you,
she said.
You feel like a door torn open in a strong wind, Ballard. An empty house full of winter wind and spinning dead leaves. Why do you think I'm talking to you? You've been nodding a lot. I'm not telling you anything new, am I? Nothing you haven't seen, been through.
Did Glad ever tell you who ran things, who was above him in the group?
I'll take that as a yes,
she said.
He never said, just the occasional hushed phone call in the hallway or outside. I sure as hell didn't ask. By the time Brett stopped being nice, I was so strung out I would have blown my fucking father if I was told to. I wanted to die. I was planning it. I tried a few times.
She showed me her wrists.
They always stopped me. It wouldn't get them off for me to just OD or bleed out. No, they had my disintegration mapped out just like the others. We were a fucking crop to be grown, harvested.
She glanced briefly at my wrists, my scars, then looked back up at me.
Then I found out about Garland, and I couldn't let them do that to me again.
Her hand fell to her swelling belly, and she caressed it.
I knew that Brett would as soon as he found out I was pregnant.
Dr. Tobias, I asked. Karen nodded.
Yeah. They either forced you into an abortion or to carry the baby to term, and then they would take it from you. You had no say in it either way. A lot of girls in the industry went to Tobias. He's one of them, you know, right? Do you smoke? I thought I smelled it on you.
I suspected Tobias was, I said. I handed her a cigarette from my pack. They took the kids and had them adopted by other Dugpa.
Yeah?
She said.
I'm pretty sure that was what happened to Brett. He said once he was adopted, said his grandfather was some kind of big guy in the group back in the 60s. I think they raised him from a baby to be so fucked up.
She tapped the cigarette against her palm and gestured for me to give her a light as she put it to her lips with slightly trembling fingers. Before I could get to my Zippo, she ran her hand over her tummy again and tossed the American Spirit down on the table.
Shit,
she said.
Never mind. Thanks anyway.
I put the cigarettes away.
Jesus Christ, how could anyone do that to an innocent little baby? It's evil. The closest I ever came to seeing God was looking into Garland's smushed-up little face that first time.
It's going to be okay, I said. I'm shutting them down.
Good luck,
she said.
You wouldn't be the first to try. If they can't seduce you, they'll fucking obliterate you and everything you hold dear. They're everywhere, hardwired into the city, into its power. I was going to kill myself and my baby before they could kill him or steal him. If Joey hadn't been there, Garland and I wouldn't be here now.
Joey and you met in the business, in the life?
Yeah, he worked for Roland Blue. He was a techie on some of the movies I worked in early on, and he was sometimes muscle for Roland to make extra money. We were friends. We weren't even fuck friends, just friends. We didn't fall in love until after we got away from all that shit. Well, he loved me before, and he wanted to get me away from Brett, from Roland, from all of it. He didn't know about the stuff with the babies, the girls being sacrificed, the whatever the hell you want to call them, club, group, society, cult, whatever, until I told him later. He's the only guy I've ever known that didn't fuck me over. He loves me. Loves Garland. He's seen me at my worst, so fucking damaged and broken, hateful, sick, mean, and he still loves me, wants our baby. We'd be dead without him. He found us a local doctor to help me get off the drugs, and then later she helped us with the baby.
Dr. Nan, I said. She nodded.
I went cold turkey in his uncle's old beach house out in Leucadia, Garland in my belly. He never left my side. Joey's uncle is dead, so no one knew about that old falling-apart place but Joey, so we were safe there. Joey didn't sleep for a month after we ran. He'd sit next to us with a gun in his lap and jump at every sound. Garland's named for Joey's uncle.
An old beach house out in Leucadia, huh? I said.
Well, that explains the cheese. The what?
Karen said. I gave her a dismissive wave. Nothing, I said. It's not important.
Here,
she said, climbing off her stool.
Let me show you.
She made her way to the living room, checked on Garland, and then plucked one of a dozen or so pictures off the shelves of an entertainment center and handed it to me. The picture was recent. It showed a handsome young black man with long dreadlocks. It was taken at a Chuck E. Cheese's restaurant, maybe during someone's birthday party. He was holding Garland and had his other arm around Karen.
Joey works at some of the equestrian centers over in Encinitas. His uncle raised him around horses.
I stood, handing the photo back to Karen. It's a beautiful family, I said, and slid the old Polaroid I had of her and her friend Dree at the concert out of my pocket. I handed it to her as well. She gasped, covered her mouth, and made a little squeak.
You talked to Dree? How is she?
She's good. Working at the bank her father works at, she said to tell you she loves you and misses you and that your cat is fine.
Oh, my God, Artemis,
she said.
She's okay?
I nodded and couldn't help but laugh a little at her excitement. You keep that picture, I said. I don't need it anymore.
You're not going to tell him about me, about us, are you?
No. I promised him I'd see if you were okay. You're doing better than okay. The son of a bitch doesn't need to know anything else.
Thank you,
she said and hugged me tight.
Please be careful. He may not take no for an answer.
It's the only answer he's going to get, I said. I promise. She hugged me again. Karen walked me to the front door. We paused by Garland, and he looked up at me and his mother.
Garland, this is Ballard. He's Mommy's friend.
The boy looked at me, and I saw the doubt on his face before he looked to his mom for reassurance.
It's okay,
she said.
I feel it too, baby. He's sad inside, but that doesn't mean he's bad.
The boy looked at me, and I could feel his judgment. I tried to play it off with a wink. Garland would have none of it.
It's hard for him, for us,
Karen said.
We feel everything like it's physical. It's wonderful, and it's terrible.
I knelt by Garland, so we were pretty much eye to eye. Good for you, Garland, I said. Be sure about who you trust, kid. He nodded and gave me a slight smile. There were gaps between his tiny teeth.
Okay,
he said.
You too.
I stood. Look after your mom and dad. You got good ones, and that's rare. Karen opened the door for me.
Thank you, Ballard,
she said. No, thank you, I said.
For what? I don't know. For making it out, I guess.
She gave me a sad smile.
The only way out is through,
she said.
But you already know that. Good luck, Ballard. Thank you for keeping us safe. Don't take this the wrong way, but I hope I never see you again.
It's okay, I said. I get that a lot.
23. On the way back to L.A., I called Vigil on the secure cell.
Where the hell are you?
He said, answering his phone. I found her, I said. Karen, I found her. She's alive and she's okay. Happy even.
What?
He said.
Wait, where? Where is she, Ballard?
She's safe and she wants to be left alone, I said. That's all Anku gets. It's more than the bastard deserves.
Okay, okay, Vigil said. Fair enough. He won't be happy, but he did agree to that. Where are you now?
Headed to LAX to meet Grinner. He's digging up some stuff for me on the cult. I'm going to close the books on them before we get the hell out of Dodge. Tell Anku I said he still owes me. I did what he wanted. I expect him to honor his side in this and try to get Tori out of her service. The line was silent.
I'm not so sure he's going to see it that way, Vigil said. He may refuse unless you give him more details. Yeah, well, that's all he gets, deal or no deal. Meet you at the mansion in a little while.
Okay,
Vigil said. His voice sounded odd. I hung up.